Good afternoon. My name is Max Whalen, and I'm Student Project Manager at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues at Dickinson College. On behalf of the Clark Forum, I'd like to welcome you to this afternoon's event, Fiction Explains Things Nonfiction Can't. Going back to Aristotle, classical Western thought has always seen art as a mere imitation of the real world. Artists interpret the reality in which they live to create something beautiful. But others, going just as far back, have always argued differently, saying that it is in fact art which creates reality, that paintings, songs, and books can influence society to such a degree that they shape the future. Today's speaker, Brian Haig, is a New York Times bestselling author of several novels, as well as a military analyst for Fox News. He served in the military for 22 years, where he obtained a master's degree in military science for Harvard University and became the special assistant to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. After his retirement from the military, he was the director and then president of Ericsson Aircrane, the manufacturer of the world's largest heavy helicopter fleet, and the president of International Business Communications. He has authored 8 novels to critical and popular acclaim, including the Sean Drummond series. His most recent publication is The Capital Game. At this time, I'd like to ask that you please turn off all cell phones and other electronic devices. A question and answer session will follow the event, so please hold your questions until then. Because the event is being filmed and some audience members may be hearing impaired, please wait until the microphone has been brought to you before asking a question. A book sale and signing will follow the event. And now please join me in welcoming Brian Haig.
First, my great appreciation to Max for that very nice welcome. And I'd like to thank all of you for coming here today, although I recognize you're just getting out of the rain. And to all of you, I want to extend my deepest sympathies right up front for being on the edge of discovery about why I write for a living and don't speak. It is a great pleasure to be here, though, and it is awfully nice to arrange what we call a Dickinson Day. And I'm awfully glad to be the lone speaker today. Because on occasions like this, I always recall the great story about Mark Twain and William Webster. Now, some of you may recall that they were both regarded as the two greatest speakers of the 19th century. And one day, Mr. Webster sent Mr. Twain a short note, an invitation, actually, more in the nature of a challenge. And he said, "Look, I think it's about time we settled which of the two of us is the greatest speaker of the century." Now, Mr. Twain, of course, never lacked in self-confidence, and he decided to go ahead and take him up on it. And on the appointed day, he showed up in Boston, and out on the Boston Commons were arraigned tens of thousands of people, all waiting to hear what was regarded as probably the greatest speaking event of the century. Well, as luck would have it, Mr. Webster went first. He went up to the podium, very confidently launched into a speech, and he unleashed an absolute bell ringer. When he cracked a joke, tens of thousands of people laughed so hard, and every time he got a little morose, they literally would join him in tears. And he went on for 30 minutes, spellbinding the audience. At the end of 30 minutes, he stepped away from the podium, and the entire crowd leaped to their feet and began clapping. And they say the applause was so loud, it literally shook New York City. Well, Webster stood there, looked at Twain, and said, "Your turn." And Twain was sort of slack-jawed, and his hands were hanging down by his sides. He walked up to the podium. He played with his bifocals a minute. He was obviously very nervous. And he looked out at the crowd, and he finally said, "Ladies and gentlemen, before coming up here today, Mr. Webster and I agreed to a rather unusual deal. We agreed that he would give my speech and I would give his." Now I'd like to thank you for the very warm welcome, but I also want to inform you that his speech was so awful I won't spoil your day. As Max noted, I went to West Point. And at West Point, back in my era, West Point was regarded as one of the two greatest engineering colleges in the United States. It trained engineers to go out and serve the country. So my undergraduate degree was in engineering. And it was 4 intense years of engineering study that taught me that I would never want to walk on a bridge that I built. So at the end of 22 years, when I retired from the Army, I faced the great decision, what am I going to do for a living? Much the same decision that a lot of your Dickinson students are going to be facing your senior year. What am I going to do for a living? Well, on the one hand, I wanted to recover from 22 years of military pay. And on the other hand, I wanted to do something that I felt was still very, very important with my life, where I could wake up in the morning and feel that I was contributing in some grand way. Now, by nature and by inclination, I should have gone into writing nonfiction. I liked the idea of writing. I liked it a great deal because at the end of 22 years, I felt really lazy. And the great thing about being a writer is if you can chip out 2-3 pages a day, that's a book a year, and that's a way to make a living. And then you can spend the rest of your day sitting in the lazy boy complaining to your wife about how intellectually exhausted you are. In looking at fiction, I thought back, and I recalled one book that always made a big impression on me. And I understand one of the main theme of the Clark Forum this year is national security. And this is a book that had a huge, huge impact on national security. It was actually a nonfiction book. And when it first came out in 1962, it was titled The Guns of August, which could be confusing if you're a fan of Solzhenitsyn because subsequent copies that came out were renamed August 1914, the same title as Solzhenitsyn's great World War I novel. The author was named Barbara Tuchman, and she won a Pulitzer Prize for the book, and she went on to win a second Pulitzer Prize for a biography of General Stilwell in World War II. And in The Guns of August, she tried to tackle what was regarded in the 1960s as the greatest historical mystery. And that mystery was, what started World War I? So here we were, 5 decades after the war ended, and historians were still trying to figure out why the Europeans stepped into one of the greatest catastrophes in the history of the world. A war that left over 15 million dead, over 20 million wounded, that upended the very balance of European politics, and that totally destroyed the European diplomatic order, and that subsequently led to, inarguably, a Second World War. And what Tuchman did is she took a look at that issue. What exactly had caused European powers to step into such manifold, widespread butchery? And the interesting thing about it is there was really no tangible cause. There was absolutely no gain for any European power that justified such a huge scale of cost. And what she came up with was a theory. And the theory was that there was no particular causes belli that led to World War I, that it was a process. And the process dictated human fate. Now, you have to understand that in that era, in any era, maintaining a large standing army is a very, very expensive proposition. And yet, what Napoleon had showed the world is that through mass conscription, you could raise these armies of millions of men, and that God was always on the side of the big battalions, as they say. So what the European leaders came up with was a system where they maintained an average-sized standing army and enormous reserves or variations on National Guard forces. And what that required was an emphasis on mobilization, where once you make a decision to mobilize, all of a sudden you could swell your army from, say, 500,000 to an army of 4 or 5 million. And each of the European nations then developed these very extensive mobilization systems. They built railroads that linked to armories, that linked to population centers so that they could shuttle population to fall in on these immense amounts of weaponry and ammunition, and then they could get them to the front in time. Now, the country that really developed into a fine science, of course, was Germany. Germany faced a particular problem, and that was called a two-front war. They had enemies on both sides. They had Russia on one side, and on the other side, they had France and England. So, and the Germans had a Prussian general staff, and with their penchant for detailed planning and a sort of anal efficiency, over a 20-year period, they kept refining and refining how they could mobilize, how they could get their forces into the fight. The long and the short of it is that you ended up with a system where every European leader had only one decision to make in the event of war, and that decision was to mobilize. So then you had a crisis occur over the assassination of the Archduke of Austria-Hungary, and Germany got involved on Austria's side and began arguing with Russia. And as tensions heated up, literally what happened was every single one of these leaders knew that the first one to mobilize had a very good chance of being the one to win. In Germany's case, it was critical to mobilize because they had these enemies on two sides. So they developed a war plan where they would mobilize faster than anybody, knock off one of the enemies, and they could turn their full might to the other enemy. The long and the short of it is that the process dictated a war. Because once tensions heated up, the Germans knew that if they dawdled, if they lost a day, if they even lost an hour, it was an incalculable advantage handed over the opponent. Well, interestingly, her book came out in 1962. And in 1963, President John Kennedy read Barbara Tuchman's book. And then in October, he found himself in a crisis called the Cuban Missile Crisis. And one of the first things he did is he turned to his executive committee, his national security advisors, during the course of that 15 days, and he asked them all to read Barbara Tuchman's book. Because what Tuchman's book showed was that you could literally march into a war without ever making a decision of whether you wanted to be in war simply because of the process. Well, at the same time, the military strategists at the Pentagon read Tuchman's book, and they noted a very alarming parallel. The parallel was because of nuclear weaponry. Both we and the Russians had these stupendously huge nuclear arsenals. And the way things worked was much like mobilization. It puts you in a time crunch. There was an enormous advantage if you executed the first strike on your opponent. Both sides had nuclear arsenals that were quite literally vulnerable to a first strike. And so it's somewhat akin to two men standing 2 feet apart holding a pistol to each other's head. The wise man pulls the trigger first. And it turns out the entire nuclear strategy and posture of the United States and the Soviet Union were much the same. And so during the Cuban Missile Crisis, for example, both Kennedy and Khrushchev understood that the first guy to pull the trigger could destroy the other guy's nuclear arsenal and thus be the only man left standing. So based on Tuchman's book, essentially there was a top-to-bottom review of the nuclear strategy and our nuclear posture. And a couple of decisions came out of that. One was to get these two guys standing 2 feet away to back off a bit. So we created hotlines and things like that to be used during crisis. But the second thing was to reshape our nuclear arsenal by building what are called SLBMs, submarine-launched ballistic missiles, because a nuclear missile in a submarine is survivable to a first strike. And thus, by having a third of your arsenal, say, underwater at any given time, it removes the incentive of the other guy to launch a first strike. He can't destroy you. It also removes the pressure you feel to launch a first strike because you know you have a survivable nuclear arsenal afterwards. So, as a result, I suppose you could probably argue that Barbara Tuchman saved the world. And if you were to make that argument, I wouldn't argue with you. I think it's probably true. So, there was my argument in favor of nonfiction. I could save the world. But then I gave some thought to fiction. And here's the thing about fiction. Money. Cash. Lucre. The largest advance in nonfiction ever went to Bill Clinton for his memoir. And in order to get a $15 million advance, he had to be elected president twice. And while my wife thinks I'm very electable, it's not shared by my neighbors. So I didn't think there was a high possibility of that. And a guy like John Grisham laughs at that advance. He writes one book a year. You can only write one memoir. He gets $25 to $30 million per book year after year. James Patterson last year made $80 million. Dan Brown, the year that the Da Vinci Code came out and took off, made almost $600 million that year. I call that inspiration. So, then the question is, could you still be important if you write fiction? Could you, your life still have meaning? Could you have an impact on the world? So what I thought of was this great novel written by Harriet Beecher Stowe called Uncle Tom's Cabin. Now, Stowe wrote this book in 1852. And interestingly, in one of those little historical quirks that a lot of people don't realize in the literary world, her next-door neighbor was the hero of my opening story, Mark Twain. And Stowe wrote this book, and if you haven't read it, it is basically a very melodramatic novel about the evils of slavery. And she created this fictional character, Uncle Tom, who was a very Christian slave and a wonderful guy, and she created the archetype villain of all time, Simon Legree. And Simon was a slave owner. And by the end of the novel, Simon Legree literally had Uncle Tom whipped to death because Uncle Tom refused to whip other slaves. And to make Uncle Tom an all more poignant figure, she literally had Uncle Tom forgive the guy who was murdering her, him as he was being murdered. It was the original blockbuster novel. It broke every sales record. 300,000 copies sold in the United States in the first year. This in an era when 300,000 copies probably meant 3 to 4 times that number read the novel. In England, it sold 1 million copies. Now, the story might be apocryphal, but supposedly when Abraham Lincoln first met Mary Beecher Stowe in the year 1862 in the White House, he walked up to her and he said, "So this is the lady that started the war." There is a book that just came out this year that tries to explain why England remained neutral during the Civil War. And the author suggests that after 3 to 4 million people in England read Uncle Tom's Cabin, as much as the English had huge sympathy for the American South and wanted to help them, because of the impact of Uncle Tom's Cabin, they didn't feel they could ever do it. And as a result, England stayed neutral in the war, and in eventuality, had England come in on the South side, that certainly the North might not have won the war. So you could argue that Marriott Beecher Stowe, as a minimum, did start a war, also, as a minimum, kept a worthy opponent out of the war, but as a minimum, she probably helped free several million American citizens from the evils of slavery. So you could say fiction could have its effect. Then I thought back to my own experience with fiction. From 1984 to 1987, I was serving on the Army staff in the Pentagon as the global strategist for the Army. And among my duties was preparing the global war plan that we'd execute against the Soviet Union. And included in that duty was incorporating all of the most sensitive classified military programs in the defense establishment, what we call black programs, incorporating those into the global war plan against the Soviet Union. Understand there was a very small cell of planners who knew about these technologies. There was the president, there was the secretary of defense, there were the service chiefs, and the rest you could count on one hand. Anyway, in 1984, a new writer who had never published a book before, an insurance salesman with no military experience, a guy named Tom Clancy, put out a book called The Hunt for the Red October. Now, in the event there's anybody here who hasn't read The Hunt for Red October, which probably includes most of the women in the room, or hasn't seen the movie, the basic plot is the captain of the newest generation Soviet submarine becomes disenchanted with the Soviet Union and secretly decides to defect. And while defecting, he's going to bring this submarine with him. Now, the submarine is equipped with a new sound suppression system that makes the submarine literally indetectable to American sonar. The purpose of the Russian submarine fleet was to hunt our nuclear submarine fleet. So that invisibility would literally upend the very nuclear balance between us and the Soviet Union. And what ensues is an underwater cat-and-mouse game that's very exciting as the United States tries to find a way to get this captain in his submarine while at the same time convincing the Russians that they had sent this captain in his submarine to Davy Jones' locker. And as a result, we would end up with the Soviet Union's most decisive new breakthrough technology without them even knowing that they had been compromised. So Clancy's first publisher was the U.S. Naval Institute Press. He could not find a popular publisher, and so he got the U.S. Naval Institute Press. And as the title suggests, it's owned by the United States Navy. Now, when it first came out, it attracted very little attention or sales. Until one day, President Ronald Reagan walked out of the White House carrying his big, thick copy under his arm and talking about what a great book it was. And I have to tell you that as book marketing goes, it's not bad to have the president out slogging your book. Not quite as good as Oprah, but it's up there. The long and the short is, of course, the book took off. Tom Clancy became a household name. Now, one of the hallmarks of The Hunt for Red October was it's what I would call excessive technical detail. There is nary a washer or a screw in a submarine that does not get one or two pages of description in his book. And it goes into huge detail about how U.S. nuclear submarines work, the insides of them, how nuclear warfare or how submarine warfare works, submarine tactics, et cetera, et cetera. Now, what got our attention in this war planning cell that I mentioned was the accuracy of some of the details, because some of them were known only to us, we thought. Now, when Clancy was subsequently asked by the press how he learned all this highly technical stuff, since, after all, he was an insurance salesman who'd never served in the military, he claimed that he found it all in public sources, in public magazines, etc. 2 years later, in 1986, Clancy put out a second novel. And building on the enthusiasm for The Hunt for Red October, the second novel also took off. It was titled Red Storm Rising, and it was about a global war between the United States and the Soviet Union. And if you haven't read the novel, which makes you among a handful of people, essentially, the key battle is on the island of Greenland. And this is where the United States and the Soviet Union decided the fate of the world on the island of Greenland, which might seem peculiar to a lot of you. Oh, sure, there was a little squabble going on along the German border, but that was not where the decisive fight was. Now, you have to understand that the reason that he chose Greenland was that the United States Navy had constructed their defense against the Soviet Navy along what is called the GIUK gap. And GIUK stands for Greenland, Iceland, and, of course, the United Kingdom. And those three island nations form a natural barrier that could lock in the Soviet Northern Fleet, which all of which were located in the Baltics, from getting to the Atlantic, which were the sea lanes between the United States and Europe. And what the Navy had done is over a 40-year period, they had developed all kinds of secret underwater installations, what is called the SOSA system, which was underwater radar that supplemented these three natural barriers and reinforced them. They were mining systems, they were torpedo systems, all kinds of things, all of which got very well described in Mr. Clancy's book. There were other technologies that were in his book that at the time were highly, highly classified. For example, he used stealth fighters, which at the time his book was written was still a top-secret program. It wasn't until Panama that we actually unveiled them to the public eye. Well, once again, Mr. Clancy went to the news and he said, I got everything through open source. Everything. The only one problem. The CIA, in my little cell, we kept an eye on what made it out to open source, and there were things inside his book that had never, ever been exposed to open source. Thus, the claim was non-credible. So at that point, we put two and two together. Now, I'll go back to the early 1960s, and I mentioned that Mr. Kennedy and the Joint Chiefs decided to build all these nuclear submarines, SLBMs they're called. And what they did is they initiated a crash program. And it's one of the more unheralded things that John Kennedy did that, again, may have saved the world. Within a few short years, we built 25 of these nuclear submarines, SLBMs, and got them out to the fleet. There was only one problem with that. It's called block obsolescence. The hull life on those submarines was assumed to be 25 years. And what that meant is, at the end of 25 years, just as a car eventually becomes, you know, too expensive to fix, but in the case of a submarine, the hull literally becomes unstable. It can no longer handle the deep pressure of its underwater duties. What that meant was, at some point, just do the math, 25 years, at some point in the 80s, we were going to have to do a crash program to rebuild the entire SLBM fleet. By that time, the price of a nuclear submarine had grown to $4 to $5 billion per copy. So multiply times 25, in 1980s dollars, you were looking at probably $100 billion, which was real money back then. And we put another thing together. A few years before, the Navy had received a request from Hollywood Studio to assist in the production of a movie. And the name of that movie, starring a hot young stud named Tom Cruise, was Top Gun. And the Navy agreed to do it, and they allowed their bases to be used as sets, and they flew all of the stunts and these kinds of things. And the result was Top Gun came out and made enough money to pay off the debt to China, but it also took care of all Navy recruiting problems for about 5 to 10 years. Every young man in America dreamed of swinging into an O club, dropping to a knee, and singing, "You've lost that love and feeling." In my case, I tried it in Army Green, and maybe it's my voice, I don't know, but I got looked at like a dork. So the Navy recognized that they could have a huge success by assisting in popular media. Last but not least, the big battle of the 80s inside the Pentagon was because Ronald Reagan had essentially given the okay for this huge expansion in the defense budget. And what occurred was a huge fight inside the Pentagon over who got the money. Now, the Navy has a peculiar way of looking at the world. They say that it is 85% water, and there are these little nuisances called continents with these pesky little irrelevant thing called people. But if you control all that H2O, you control the world. And the Navy had developed something called a maritime strategy. And the maritime strategy, if you read Tom Clancy's book, you now understand what it is. It essentially required a 600-ship Navy. That was a huge expansion from the 346-ship Navy that Jimmy Carter had deeded to Ronald Reagan. And the differential was hundreds of billions of dollars. Now, by 1986 and 87, the Navy share of the defense budget swelled to 36%. And if you were to make the argument that Tom Clancy got a little help from the Navy in writing his books, I wouldn't argue with you. If you were also to make the argument that the Navy would have gotten all that largesse without Tom Clancy's help, I might argue with you. That's just a subtle way that you can see the effect of fiction, even on national policy and even on hundreds of billions of dollars of defense expenditure. Which carries me to one of my favorite authors, John Grisham. Now, Grisham, as you all know, is an attorney. He's a lawyer. And this is another story that might be apocryphal, but I think it's true. Grisham harbored this secret desire as a lawyer to write a great novel. Now, he grew up in the town of Oxford, and if there are any literary archaeologists here, you'll recognize that that's the hometown of the greatest Southern writer of all time, William Faulkner. And Grisham's first attempt was to write a book that was called The Time to Kill. And he spent something like 5 or 6 years working as a lawyer to feed his family and writing this great, great novel, A Time to Kill. When he finally had it ready, he sent it up to New York, and he received several hundred rejections, and he finally found a small publisher. They put the book out, and within a year or two, it only sold 3,000 copies. And I have to tell you that that does not make you a hero in American publishing in New York. So he was disappointed, dispirited, and swore he would never write another book. And he went back to doing what he did, which is to hang around the Memphis, Tennessee courtroom and see what business he could pick up to feed his family. And then, as lawyers are wont to do, every night he and a group of fellows like him would retire to the local tavern and sit there and drink their woes away. And one night, one of the guys, on his fifth beer, turned to Grisham and said, "You know what, John, you know what your problem was? You tried to write the great American novel. I mean, if you've read A Time to Kill, you know that it's a rewrite of another great American novel called To Kill a Mockingbird. The same themes, the same basic kind of story, and he does it much better." So this lawyer says to him, "Your mistake was what people want is they want entertainment. They want relief." And one of the other drunk lawyers looks at him and said, "Yeah, you know what you should have done? You should have made a law firm here in Memphis that was like owned by, oh, I don't know, say the mafia." And another drunk lawyer says, "Yeah, your hero is a guy. He graduated from Harvard Law School. He's number one in his class. He comes down, he joins the law firm, and he has no idea of what he stepped into." Within about 3 to 4 months, Grisham had written the firm. He sent it to New York. It sold a gazillion copies. A Time to Kill was reissued and spent 3 years on the New York Times bestseller list. And one of the things that I love about Grisham, despite having learned that example that said, write for entertainment, not social import, he has gone on in his career, if you review his novels, to write a series of novels that are mostly issue-driven, that have great importance. Most recently, he wrote a novel that essentially shows the evils of electing local judges instead of having them appointed at state levels and how corporations can then flood those communities with money and pervert the kinds of justices that are going to be appointed, or excuse me, voted in. If you're still not persuaded that fiction is the way to go, I want you to consider a writer named Ayn Rand, who was a highly opinionated political slash social slash economic philosopher. And when she decided to write her great books, she wrote them as novels. When Ronald Reagan became president, aside from his apparent liking of Tom Clancy, he always quoted Ayn Rand. And if you go to the Tea Party movement rallies today, the required reading to even walk in the rally is an Ayn Rand novel. Or you can consider L. Ron Hubbard, who literally, in attempting to create a modern religion called Scientology, decided to do it on the basis of 3 or 4 novels. And he has literally founded a religion based on it. My point to all of you aspiring Dickinson graduates is you can do a lot worse to make a living than by writing fiction. Not only can you make buku money, but you, of course, can also have a huge, huge impact on society, the way people think. And last but not least, if you're paying attention, you're looking up here, and you're saying to yourself, "Hey, that guy up there, he's not all that impressive. And if that boob can make a living doing it, I know I can do it." All of which brings me to one more memory from when I was a second lieutenant in the Army. And at the time, I was in a division in Germany, and we had a 2-star general as a commander who was a real hard-nosed fella. And he was one of those guys that liked to start every single talk by putting you down. And one day, he came to my community in Germany, and all my lieutenants from my battalion had to go up into the conference room, and he walked in, he went up to the stage, took the podium, and looked around at us in typical fashion. He said, "Today I'm going to talk about what it takes to be a great officer. Now, if there's anybody in this audience who thinks you're too stupid to be a great officer, stand up now." Well, there was a pause for about a minute, and finally a friend of mine, a lieutenant, stood up, And we all just kind of looked at this guy and thought, what are you doing? Even the general finally looked at him and said, you think you're too stupid to be a good officer? And the guy looked at me and said, well, no, not really. But I noticed you were the only guy standing, and I thought you were lonely. So with that, I think it's time for questions and answers or for me to sit down.
We're going to begin the question and answer session at this time. If you can just notify one of the student project managers if you have a question, and we'll take questions in the order that we see them. Preference will be given to students.
I'm actually a student of life, actually, but not a student here necessarily. Just a little bit off topic, but I wanted to ask you if you had read Ken Follett's Fall of Giants, and if you thought, if you have read it, that it was fairly close to the truth for how World War I got started.
No, actually, I haven't read it. I did an event with him about 4 months ago in New York. And Ken Follett is one of the, he's been putting out bestsellers since the 60s. And if you can ever get him down here, you really want to. He's the most charming speaker I think I've ever heard. But no, I haven't read it yet.
How do you think your own writing has affected society?
How do my books affect society? Have you read them? They haven't. It's interesting. The most important thing that convinced me to write was I read a Tom Clancy book after I retired from the Army. And I hate to sound catty, but I read the book and I said, this was awful. And if this guy can make $400 or $500 million doing this, I can make a living. And what I did is I went out and I read the New York Times bestseller list. And I figured the reason that somebody's on that list is that they've kind of got it figured out, how to write something that people like to read. And I settled on two writers. And one was a guy named John Grisham, and the other was a guy named Nelson DeMille. And I read all their books, and I really looked at how they write and what they do. And not for nothing, when my first book came out, about 70% of the critics said, hey, this guy is a mix between Grisham and DeMille. Thanks. Really? And what I liked was, from Grisham, I like how, in his case, it's social import. He looks at legal issues, he looks at social issues, and that gives, not all of his books, but it gives them an edge over most other books. So I wanted to do that in my books. And always, almost always, before I start writing, I try to think of what's the theme, what's the message. And that makes it a little bit more than a thriller. That makes it something that, you know, you carry away with you. And I really like Nelson DeMille because he's funny as hell. And so I wanted to have humor. So with each book, what I try, not always, sometimes I write it just for sheer entertainment. But typically what I try to do is to give you something to consider. So, you know, my first novel was about how hard it is when you get involved in things like Kosovo, how difficult they are. The second one was about gays in the Army, and this was 10, 11, 12 years ago, and I always thought that gays should be able to serve, and I wanted to write a novel that sort of did that. It didn't sell real well. Two books ago, it was interesting, I had a Russian guy came to me on the internet, and his name was Alex Sasikin, and Alex had read my fourth novel, which was about how things went wrong in Russia during the era of reforms. And Alex said, hey, look, you know, you might want to write a book about me. Now, I have to tell you that as a writer, you get that pretty often. There's a bridge inspector up in New York who's been hounding me for 10 years to write a novel about him and his adventures inspecting bridges. So, you know, I sort of thought, yeah, okay. And then he sent me the 60 Minutes story that was done on him. And then I researched him a bit, and I decided this would make a fascinating tale. Alex went to Moscow University in the mid-80s. When he took their equivalent of SATs, the national exam to get into colleges, he had the second highest score in the entire Soviet Union. Alex was a Mensa times six. And he went to Moscow University, and his sophomore year, in his spare time, he began doing private construction work to make money so that he could vacation on the side. And he got turned in to the KGB, and they came to the university. And despite the fact that Alex was a physics major at Moscow University, and thus a guy that they wanted to go into these nuclear programs, et cetera, they booted him out of Moscow University. 2 years later, Alex had established the largest construction firm in Russia. He owned about 15 architects and about 600 workers. And at the time, he decided to start backing a politician who was a very ambitious guy, who had been the mayor of Moscow. He'd also been in the Politburo. And his name was Yeltsin. And Alex literally paid for Yeltsin's election to the presidency of Russia. Thus, you might say Alex won the Cold War. And by that time, he was worth $200 to $300 million. And he was an absolutely brilliant businessman. When you study the ways that he made money, it wasn't corruption. He was brilliant. And he found every edge. But by 91 or 92, Moscow had become a criminal war zone. And Alex, by that time, had several thousand employees. And he made the only mistake that he made in the construction of this huge financial empire. He hired the former head of the KGB to head his corporate security, which was very much a case of the fox coming into the hen house. 2 years later, Alex and Elena went on a business trip to Eastern Europe. He was kidnapped, tortured, and forced to sign over everything to the former head of the KGB. But he and his wife, Elena, escaped. And in a very hurried process, they had to flee. And they knew if they came back to Russia, they'd be killed. So instead, they booked flights to the United States, the one place in the world where they thought, the KGB had no influence. In fact, was regarded as an enemy. They came here, and Alex immediately began starting a new business. Unfortunately, 2 years after he arrived, Janet Reno, the Attorney General, and Louis Freeh, the head of the FBI, visited Moscow, and they wanted to expand the FBI station that was in the embassy, the American embassy. And they walked in and met with Russia's justice minister, and he said, sure, I'll let you grow that station on one condition, give me Alex. And what ensued was a nightmare the likes of which you can't imagine happening in this country. Alex spent 3 years in American prison. His wife, Elena, spent 2 years in prison. It was a 10-year process. Unfortunately, for the Justice Department, we do not have an extradition treaty with Russia, which meant that in order to get Alex shipped out of the United States, you literally have to go in an American immigration court, and you, the foreign country, essentially have to prove your case, or at least substantiate it to that immigration judge who can then order your extradition. The long and the short of it is, in three different attempts in court, where eventually the Justice Department lawyer who had led the effort twice to get Alex shipped out, literally came to Alex's defense lawyer and said, look, this is all a put-up job. This is all a total sham. All of the evidence against him was cooked up in a former KGB back room. This is really bad stuff. So just before Alex contacted me, he and Elena were living out free again, and he got a call from his lawyer. And the lawyer said, look, Alex, I don't know how to break this to you, but this weekend, the FBI is going to kidnap you, put you on an airplane, and send you to Moscow. So Alex said to his lawyer, what should I do? He said, well, my advice is flee. So Alex and Elena jumped into a car, headed north, and literally on the Freedom Bridge to cross into Canada, an FBI SWAT team came down on them from a helicopter. They took them to a private jet. They took them down to Washington, D.C. Now, this is only 6 or 7 years ago. And they brought them into the Russian embassy. And the only thing that needed to be done now is the Russian embassy needed to stamp Alex's passport to ship him from here to there. So they walked in with Alex and Elena in cuffs. And unfortunately, the ambassador to Russia, who was in the know on this whole thing, was gone for the weekend. So the Russian charge of affairs was there, the number two guy. And he walked up and he said, "What would you like?" And the FBI guy said, "Stamp the paper and we're going to take him up to JFK, put him on a plane to Moscow." And the charge of affairs started to stamp and he looked up and he said, "Do you two want to go to Russia?" And actually he went, "No." The FBI guys are stamping their foot, stamp it, stamp the paper. And he said, "No, I can't do this. I have to make phone call back to Moscow. Nobody's at work until, 10 o'clock tonight. And I won't stamp it until I get my instructions." The long and the short of it is the judge, who had twice decided in Alex's favor, called the director of the FBI and said, "If you put him on an airplane, I'm going to issue a warrant for you for kidnapping," which is how Alex became free. So when Alex came to me, I said, "Boy, this is a great story. This is a way to really tell everybody in America how it is things have gone so horribly wrong in Russia." But I wasn't about to write it as nonfiction, because that takes too long. Plus, of course, given the number of public figures involved, it would be a very difficult thing to do. So I wrote it as a novel. How big an effect did it have? I don't know. But by writing it as a novel and thus really getting inside Alex's head and letting you know the characters, what I hope is that it gives you a much stronger feel for what it feels like to be caught in the grinding machine that the Kremlin is today. The Hunted. And I think it's for sale. Sir?
MASH came out as a movie, not as a book first, and obviously that was at a time when we had a draft. Based on the atmosphere now with an all-volunteer army, would a humorous anti-war book or movie be successful?
What I tell you is, it's amazing what can sell in this country. And if you don't believe it, think of Dan Brown. We are the last great Christian nation on earth, by all statistics and figures. The Da Vinci Code is a dagger in the heart of Christianity. It says that Jesus Christ was an ordinary man who had an affair with a woman, unmarried, produced a child, and the Catholic Church has now spent all these centuries hiding it from us. Now, if Dan Brown were a Muslim, he would have 10,000 fatwas on him. He'd be dead. In America, we make it the biggest bestseller of the decade, and he gets 500 made. If you write a book well, and it's a good story, it'll sell. And I think it's irrelevant of timing. I will always look at Dan Brown and say, "Boy, that is something."
You talk a lot about realistic fiction affecting the world. Do you think other forms of fiction, like fantasy or sci-fi or anything of that nature, could also have such a great effect?
I'm sorry.
Sorry. So I asked if you thought anything but realistic, if other forms of fiction that isn't necessarily realistic fiction could have the same effect as realistic fiction.
Can you repeat the question?
Yeah. The question is, all I've been talking about is sort of fact-based fiction. Can non-fact-based fiction have the same effect? Yeah, I think it can. There's a girl in England who was on social welfare, a single mother, and within 1 year she was the richest woman in England, and it's total fantasy. Now, how much social import do her books have? You have to remember that most of the readers of J.K. Rowling's books are kids, and kids have not yet developed opinions and views of things. And so here is a five-book series, and in it you're going to learn an awful lot about human interaction, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, my favorite was a guy named J.D. Salinger. You have to understand that Salinger went to my high school. I was at the private school he ran away from. And there was a plaque over my bed that said J.D. Salinger slept here. And that dumb private school used to send him an invitation every year to come back and speak. He never answered for 50 years. Catcher in the Rye, you know, for all of us, that kind of explains being a teenager. I think any venue of fiction, particularly if you have something to say, if you're not just writing just to entertain, you know, good guys versus bad guys, if you have something to say, fiction, I think, is the best way to do it. You know, the difference between fiction and nonfiction is that you can move people with fiction. You can create a sympathetic character like Uncle Tom, and when Simon Legree kills him, you hate Simon Legree. And you don't even stop to think that he's imaginary. All of a sudden, he's every southern slave owner. So, yeah, I think there's, you know, almost any kind of fiction. Except romance.
there's a wonderful novel by Umberto Eco called Bartolino. And Bartolino, have you read it? It's a guy in the Middle Ages who has two talents. He's a brilliant linguist. He can pick up languages quickly. But his real talent is he is a flawless liar. He basically spins tall tales. He goes from town to town inventing stories about the miracle he's witnessed or the unicorn he's ridden. And then he comes back through these towns 10 years later only to discover that the fantasies that he created are now the truths of those villages. These people live and die by these facts. And so that's a long way of leading into the question about moral hazard. If you're an extremely influential, popular writer or filmmaker, and you're working in this field that you call fact-based fiction, and suddenly that you've contributed to the blurring of those distinctions, what role do you play? What responsibility do you have?
And what was Umberto Eco's most famous book?
The Name of the Rose.
Did you ever hear the tale about why he said he wrote it?
To make money.
He said, I woke up one morning and I wanted to kill a monk. it's interesting. I mean, the era where I came into writing thrillers is like 2000 to today. And the world has become a very uncertain place. The Cold War, particularly by the time, you know, by the time it ended in 1990, the Cold War was like this big, huge cast, and everything, including in the thriller world, everything went through that prism of the Cold War. And everything was explained via the Cold War. For example, what country is important to you outside of your border? Well, it was all relative to the Cold War. So there were countries that we thought were irrelevant to us and we paid no attention to, and there were countries we thought were vitally important to us, and there we would do anything. Once the Cold War ended, for thriller writers, it was a whole new deal. And all of us, to a greater or lesser degree, are sort of trying to make some sense out of this world, what it is. And some of them, I think, are somewhat, you know, irresponsible. They teach, for example, that it's good to torture prisoners. Now, is that actually going to inspire a CIA guy to sit down and torture the prisoner? You know, well, I read a Vince Flynn book, and so I'm going to give you what, you know, his guy Rap is going to give you. I don't think there is that much, you know, there's not moral hazard per se. I mean, but I think it goes a long way to, a lot of people want to sort of gain their understanding of the world around the chewing gum of thrillers, fictional novels. The average male adult in the United States last year, over 50% did not read a single book, not one. Not a Microsoft training manual, not one. 80% of books are bought by women. What's the point of that? men are really dumb. But what it kind of comes into is I don't think the fiction, in a major sense, causes people to get up and want to be like Mitch Rapp and kill guys or be this guy's character who walks around from town to town and beats up people. But I could be wrong.
Just a quick follow-up. Picking up on Doug's question, because I think the recent experience of the TV show 24 would be the perfect example of perhaps not having a causal effect upon a particular interrogation, but that it contributes to a change of attitude, a change of culture. And I believe Doug might be referring to that kind of moral responsibility of a fiction writer.
I would say to each his own. There are certain fiction writers, Brad Thor, Vince Flynn, both of who have been advisors to 24, for example. The world of novels is as much a war of ideas as anything else. There are other guys like George Pelicanos who, you know, write novels that are very, from a much more liberal sort of position. There's a whole mix out there. Now, you can tell by the sales figures where people sort of lean. They buy Vince Flynn and they buy Brad Thor. And they watch 24. I think those people are, for example, if the issue was torturing prisoners, I think those people are inclined to believe that that's the right thing to do before they ever read one of those novels. And when they read the novel, it's much like people's cable news viewing habits. You know what I mean? Republicans do watch Fox. They find it, you know, soothing. liberals do watch MSNBC because they find it appropriately enraging. You migrate. And so in the book world, it's the same way. I mean, I don't imagine that, you know, for example, a lot of women, when they're walking to a bookstore, they'll see one of my books on the shelf and they go, oh, military guy. Not a book I want to read. Military guy. Readers make these kinds of judgments. And so now, let's take my friend Dan Brown again. Anybody here read The Da Vinci Code? Who are the bad guys in Da Vinci Code? Who in the Catholic Church? Who has a killer monk that's going around? Opus Dei. Anybody here know anything about Opus Dei? Now, bear in mind that Dan at the front of that book says everything in this is fact, right? Opus Dei does not belong to the church. It is a lay organization, 100% lay. There are no priests, there are no nuns, there are no crazy monks. So Dan immediately, see what I mean? So he's creating this fictional story, and if people are inclined to not like the Catholic Church to begin with, they'll maybe read Dan's book and they'll buy in the inaccuracies in it. But did I answer that question okay, or am I?
We have a time for one more question.
Going off the previous question, I was wondering that about novels that are like based on fact but aren't factual. Like, I know I've heard about novels that based on real events that are slightly changed that insinuate things like that TWA 800 was shot down by friendly fire, that Lyndon Johnson killed President Kennedy, or just other conspiracies, you know, the church has been covering up Jesus' bloodline, things like that that have been insinuated in novels that are based on fact. And also, do you think that, coupled with the rise of conspiracy theories spreading via the internet, talk radio, and even cable channels, do you think that people at this point, a lot of regular people read a novel and view it as fact, or you see things on the news and view it as fiction? Does it make it harder or impossible for people to distinguish fact from fiction, conspiracy theories from the truth, because of novels such as The Da Vinci Code and others of that ilk?
I guess it is possible. But, you know, when you buy a book and it says fiction, it's like buyer beware, if you know what I mean. You're supposed to understand the distinction. There's a reason why it's called fiction. I mean, my favorite are the guys that write a memoir and swear it's true. And then Oprah has you all over the show. And then it turns out your fiction is, you know. I mean, when that guy was talking about pulling his own teeth with a set of pliers, you know, I'm talking about James Frey. He's, you know. I remember I got to that and went, no way. You know what I mean? And you ought to, you know, a discriminating reader ought to do the same thing with a novel, particularly when it says fiction. You ought to say, okay, this guy's not a, you know, he's not really a historian.
Can you join me in thanking the Saturday speaker?
Wanted to remind you that there's a book sale and signing right over here, following the presentation. That concludes this afternoon's presentation. Thank you very much.